you are standing and expressing this is both an incredibly dangerous moment in American history, but also an amazingly possible moment. When it's white folks in pain, we understand there are systemic causes. When it's black and brown folks in pain, we ignore the system and we focus on the individual and we blame them because we lack radical empathy.
You have to say black lives matter rather than all lives matter, because we said all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. We said all, but we didn't mean all.
The whole history of America is the history of rich white men telling working class white people that their enemies are black and brown.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise, a project of Speak Out, the nation's premier nonprofit speakers bureau, which for over 25 years has been bringing educators and activists to campuses and communities across America to engage in meaningful dialogue about the pressing issues that confront our country and the world. If you enjoy the program, one way you can express your support is to become a monthly patron and sustainer of the show by signing up at www.patreon.com/speakoutwithtimwise. You can pledge as little as $2 a month or as much as you'd like, and not only know that you're supporting our efforts, but also gain access to bonus content, like premium commentaries on the events of the week, as well as signed books or DVDs. And all donations are tax deductible as they go directly to Speak Out to support their nonprofit activist mission. You can also make a one-time donation to the program at speakoutnow.org via PayPal, and make sure to subscribe to the show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. On this episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise, I feature a panel discussion held at the National Conference on Race and Ethnicity in Higher Education, which was held in late May, early June of this past year in Portland, Oregon. The conversation, which was held on May 30th at the NCORE conference, was titled Affirmative Action, the Model Minority Myth, and Fighting Back Against Right-Wing Divide and Conquer. And in this taping, my panelist and I talk about the way that historically and today, Asian Americans are often used as a foil for right-wing assaults on diversity efforts or affirmative action efforts on campus. Conservatives for decades now have pointed to Asian Americans as quote-unquote model minorities and claim that they are now the ones being discriminated against in elite college admissions to make way for supposedly less qualified Black and Latinx students who have lower scores or lower qualifications overall. By making this argument, the right has hit upon a very cynical but potentially very effective way to divide and conquer people of color from one another, because historically, the right always talked about affirmative action as victimizing angry white men and increasingly white women, but now they have fastened upon this very different strategy, which is making Asian Americans the ones who were being harmed. That's been the strategy of the right-wing lawyers who took on the affirmative action case against Harvard University, which is working its way through the courts right now. As I'm recording this, there has actually been a victory for Harvard and for affirmative action at the district court level, but of course that is going to be appealed, and it remains to be seen as to whether or not the Supreme Court will ultimately uphold Harvard's affirmative action plan or get rid of it. But what's especially dangerous about the lawsuit is that the very same attorneys who took this lawsuit, supposedly representing the interest of Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, are the very same attorneys who have been trying to get rid of affirmative action by representing supposedly discriminated against white people for quite a long time. So there's a very cynical use of Asian Americans, and my guest and I are going to talk about how that has played out historically, what the functions of this model minority myth really are, and why it is so important for us to have not only the intellectual but the rhetorical ammunition to fight back against this attempt to split Asian folk away from Black and Latino folk and Indigenous folk in the larger struggle for racial equity. My panelists for this conversation were Dr. Helen Zia, Dr. Nolan Cabrera, Dr. David Pilgrim, and Dr. Mary D'Anico, and I will be introducing them in the panel itself as it actually played out at the NCORE conference in Portland. Enjoy. Thank you for coming to today's live taping of Speak Out with Tim Wise, the podcast. This is the second of three of these that I'll be doing here at the conference. I'm going to introduce my guest, and then I'm going to sort of do a setup for this particular episode and the conversation that I'm wanting to have today. Let's get started. As you know, the title of today's session is Affirmative Action, the Model Minority Myth, and Fighting Back Against Right-Wing Divide and Conquer. And again, I'll explain my thinking behind doing the session in just a second, but first, let me introduce my guest. I'm going to start directly to my right with Dr. Nolan Cabrera. He is an associate professor in the Center for the Study of Higher Education at the University of Arizona. His new book, White Guys on Campus, is an exploration of white male racism and occasional anti-racism on college campuses. He is also one of three academic expert witnesses for the plaintiffs in the Tucson Unified School District's Mexican American Studies case. He is a recipient of the prestigious Education Early Career Award, the Spencer National Academy of Education Postdoc Fellowship. Dr. Cabrera's publications have appeared in the leading education and higher ed journals, such as American Educational Research Journal, Teachers College Record, Review of Higher Education, Journal of College Student Development, and Research in Higher Education. And his work has been used extensively in education policy and legal environments. Please welcome Nolan Cabrera to the show. Directly to my left is Mary DiNicco. Dr. DiNicco is the director of the Asian American Transnational Research Initiative at Cal Poly Pomona. She is the author of three books, the editor of a four-volume encyclopedia on Asian American society, and countless articles on Korean Americans, youth, Asian Americans, and transnational issues. She founded the Peer Mentor Program and is currently launching a peer coaching program at Cal Poly to explore its impact on student success. Her current research is on millennials and post-millennials, who she refers to as iGens. She examines how iGens consume and express their identity, politics, and goals for the future. Please welcome Mary DiNicco to the program. Next to Mary is Dr. Helen Zia, a writer, community activist, and Fulbright scholar who has spent 12 years working on her newest book, Last Boat Out of Shanghai. Dr. Zia is a longtime journalist. She was executive editor of Ms. Magazine, and her articles, essays, and reviews have received awards for her groundbreaking story. She's also authored Asian American Dreams, The Emergence of an American People, and, along with Wen Ho Lee, My Country Versus Me. She has been outspoken on issues ranging from civil rights and peace to women's rights and countering hate, violence, and homophobia. Helen's work is featured in the Oscar-nominated documentary Who Killed Vincent Chen, and she was profiled in Bill Moyer's Becoming American, The Chinese Experience. Please welcome Dr. Helen Zia to the program. And last but certainly not least, we have Dr. David Pilgrim. He is the founder and director of the Jim Crow Museum, which is the nation's largest publicly accessible collection of racist objects located at Ferris State University in Michigan, where he serves as vice president for diversity and inclusion. Dr. Pilgrim is also the author of Understanding Jim Crow, Using Racist Memorabilia to Teach Tolerance and Promote Social Justice, which explains the museum's vision and work where these objects are used as tools to teach about race, race relations, and racism. His second book, Watermelons, Nooses, and Straight Razors, examines the origins and significance of several longstanding anti-black stories and the caricatures and stereotypes that undergird them. Pilgrim's writings, many of them found at the Jim Crow Museum website, which is at ferris.edu/Jim Crow, are used by scholars, students, and civil rights and human rights workers to better understand historical and contemporary expressions of racism. Please join me in welcoming Dr. David Pilgrim to the show. So I'm going to start off by explaining a little bit about my thinking in terms of putting together this panel. You know, when we were sitting around, the Speak Out folks who sponsor the podcast and myself, trying to figure out what three sessions did we want to do, my thinking was I wanted to have sessions that really spoke to some of the burning issues on campuses right now, some of the things that are going on at this particular moment. And of course, one of those things is the current lawsuit against Harvard University's affirmative action program, in which the plaintiff's attorneys have hit upon, I think, a very devious, frankly,
a very cynical but possibly a very effective strategy. As you know, if you have followed the affirmative action wars over the years, it has usually been the case that the attorneys who take on these so-called reverse discrimination cases go find a white plaintiff, right? Used to be white men in the 70s, and then it became white women because that seemed a little bit less obvious what they were trying to do, right? And then I think after a while, they realized the most effective approach might be to actually find plaintiffs who are also of color and claim that they are the real victims of affirmative action for other groups of color in a way to divide people of color from one another. And so, as you know, the plaintiffs in this case are Asian American students represented by a lawyer and law and legal team out of Houston that are notorious for their anti-affirmative action hostility and hostility toward diversity and equity initiatives. And I think this, to me, speaks to a longer pattern that I have noticed going back at least the 30 years that I've been doing this work, which is this sort of insipid use and misuse and manipulation of Asian American and Pacific Islander folks in this country as a wedge against black folks, increasingly as a wedge against Latinx folks, increasingly as a wedge to divide people of color whose experiences with white supremacy, though they are obviously not the same, are all quite real. And instead of figuring out ways to build solidarity across these lines of race and ethnicity, nationality and culture, we end up having Asian folks pitted against black folks, pitted against brown folks, pitted against white folks, pitted against everybody, pitted against indigenous people, right? And so I wanted to have that conversation both because of what's happening with the Harvard case, but more in terms of what it represents in a historical context. Because one of the things that I think we all know if we do race work is that too oftentimes Asian American and Pacific Islander folks are completely left out of the conversation, or they are lumped in as one monolith as opposed to the 20 plus Asian and Pacific Islander nationalities that exist within the United States or are represented within the United States. They are either ignored or they are looked at as a monolith, or we don't quite know how to talk about the Asian American role within this larger context and within this larger discussion. And as a result, we just neglect the way in which Asian peoples have been racialized throughout the course of not just the last 20 and 30 years, but for the course of well over a century. And I think if we don't know that history, and we don't understand the way in which Asian people have been utilized within the context of racism and white supremacy in this country, then it becomes very hard to understand what's going on right now. So I want to start, I'm going to ask a question of each of the panelists, and then we'll ask some more broad and general questions that anyone on the panel can answer. I'm going to start off with Helen. And what I'd like to do for the audience is to sort of set a connection between the contemporary and the historical. So how should we understand the connection between some of these issues that are currently happening, the way in which Asian American folks are being used in the affirmative action case, the way in which the whole concept of the model minority has been used to drive a wedge between Asian peoples and non-Asian peoples of colors? How do we understand the connection to history?
Well, thanks, Tim. This is a very important topic because as we move into the next decade, and people say the next two decades, when there will be no majority race in America, we are coming at a time where divide and conquer is the only way that, especially white supremacists, you know, the idea of holding on to power can only be done by keeping people divided. And to paint a different picture, it's to say, if we could come together, the people in this room, and have unity, we already have power. So historically, let me say, I'm 67 years old. I grew up during the 50s and 60s. When I was a kid in high school and the civil rights movement was in full bloom, and as an Asian American kid growing up in New Jersey, I really identified with the civil rights movement because I knew I was a minority. And I knew that because people were always telling me, go back where you come from, or Ching Chong Ah So, and all that stuff, and fights on the playground, or teachers who looked at all of us kids post-war with Japan, post-war with Korea, the current war then Vietnam, and so all of the enemies were Asian. And when I went to the movies, you know, the Saturday matinees, and they were war movies, and there would be that crescendo where kids would rise up and say, kill them, kill them, kill them. And when the lights went down, the them were people who looked like me as a kid. So there was no question in those days that Asians were the enemy. And up until the history, the context of Asians in America, beginning at the, and believe it or not, the 1500s and 1600s when Asians on this continent were first documented, Asians were looked at as the enemy, as the threat. I'm not going to do Asian Americans 101 here, but I have to say, if you don't have Asian American studies on your campuses, you really have to, because to understand this topic and to build unity at all, part of it is to understand our own histories and each other's histories and build our unity from there. But so there are many, many books and courses and so forth about how federal law, state law, California, the entire West Coast was a place where there was ethnic cleansing against Asians in America. Idaho used to have, at one point, the largest population racially in Idaho was Chinese. And why isn't that true now? Because they were ethnically cleansed, and that meant there were massacres, lynchings, and things like that. But so when I was a kid, I identified with the African-American civil rights movement. And in our high schools, we would have walkouts all the time and teach-ins to have support for the civil rights movement. And standing there with other kids, being one of the few Asians in my school, I remember one day being in the schoolyard after a walkout, and we're all talking about an America where we each could be seen for the content of our character and not the color of our skin. And one of my friends, I was standing with black and white friends, and one of my friends turned to me and said, "Helen, you've got to decide whether you're black or white." And, you know, as an Asian American kid, and this is before there was even an Asian American movement, I didn't know how to answer because I knew I wasn't black or white, but there wasn't a way to sort of formulate who are Asians in America. And so fast forward to today, I have to say I think that's still the case. And if you want to know how did Asian Americans come from being the enemy in incarcerating 120,000 Asian Americans, Japanese Americans during World War II because they were too dangerous to be among regular non-Asian Americans, to go from there to suddenly being honorary white people, to becoming the model minority. Well, there's an actual historical moment when that happened. 1966, January 1966, the New York Times had an article about Japanese Americans, an American success story, not written by an Asian American, but by an Anglo-American sociologist, who then a few months later had another article published in U.S. World and News Reports in 1966 that then talked about Chinese Americans being the new model minority, and that's where it was coined. And just to paraphrase the very first sentence of one of those articles, it was something like, "At a time when America is awash with racial tension, one minority is moving ahead quietly by dint of its own hard work, not a welfare check." Now, in that one opening sentence, how many stereotypes can you find in there? And that's the opening gambit for using Asian Americans as a wedge. I mean, only a few years earlier than that, for the 100-plus years prior to that, Asian Americans were subhuman. It was 1966 that this was defined. And what was happening in 1966, that was the height of the civil rights movement. And that's where the beginning of this model minority happened. And as an activist during those years, there were so many times when, you know, it was a movement of people of color. And Asians were included in that. Yellow, brown, black, white, you know, all the people must unite. But Asian Americans too, many of whom grow up believing and saying things in conversations I have, well, what's wrong with being a model? What's wrong with being the good minority? Well, part of that is, well, if you're the good minority, then so is there a bad minority? Mm-hmm. And what does that mean? And also the point is, what's wrong with having a good stereotype? Well, every stereotype is bad. The whole idea is you're painting people as a monolith, good or bad, and that then you lose the people's essential humanity. So anyway, there's so much more that I'm sure we'll all talk about, but that's sort of in a thumbnail. And so today, I think we get to a place like this Harvard lawsuit, which, by the way, the vast majority of Asian Americans do not go to elite schools. Right. They go to community colleges. Right. They go to state schools. They have the same struggles about money versus education and how to get there. But by depicting all Asian Americans as, you know, Harvard material, and really, you know, this is like the least most important topic in Asian American communities. But it has become the one thing that everybody else thinks is on the mind of Asian Americans.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much. So, Mary, I want to talk to you a little bit about, I know you do a lot of research on youth in particular, and I'm interested in the way that you may see or know of younger Asian folk. How do they look at the racialization of the Asian community? So we know, obviously, if folks have been around long enough to remember the Asian as the enemy that Helen was talking about, and maybe then the switch to the so-called model minority, there's a historical context that by definition such folks will have. For younger Asian American folks who are coming of age at a time when that model minority has been this dominant trope, where that's the thing that has been said, where, you know, books like the Tiger Mom book that Amy Chua did, I mean, these sort of images of these hardworking, all very successful Asian folks have been drilled constantly, and maybe that historical memory isn't there. Do you sense, or I guess the question is, how do you see younger Asian American folk, Asian youth, how do they think about these stereotypes and images? How do they push back against them? Do you see more resistance to them, more of a willingness to challenge that, less of a willingness to do so, or just maybe confusion about what is the proper way to understand that? A little bit of what Helen was saying, you know, what's wrong with it? How do you see young people coming to that question in the Asian community?
Well, that's a packed question, right? I really appreciate Helen's comment about the need for ethnic studies in Asian American studies courses, because there is a void. The reality is what happened historically for API, Asian Pacific Islander communities, is that we still remain marginalized and invisible. What's different now is there's multi-generations of Asian Americans, Pacific Islanders, where they don't have the consciousness of the civil rights movement. They don't know the history. They don't realize that Yuri Kochiyama held the head of Malcolm X when he was assassinated. They don't realize that Richard Aoki was part of the Black Panthers movement, the Third World Liberation Front. There's a lot of things that the coalition that was held and fought for by a lot of the amazing, fierce activists, they have no consciousness of that. In addition, Asian Americans are not a monolithic group. Unlike Latinos, who speak predominantly the same language, Asian Americans speak multiple languages. We're different. We don't have the same religion. We don't have the same language. We don't have the same history. We don't have the same SES background. And if you look at East Asian Americans versus Southeast Asian Americans or South Asian Americans, the refugee climate and the experiences of what we have called the boat people or the folks who fled the Khmer Rouge genocide, it's strikingly different. And so when you talk to young people today, the narratives of Asian Americans are complex. We're not the same. And the thing is that most people do struggle. We have people whose families work in sweatshops. We have folks who are undocumented. And in fact, Asian Americans are actually a higher proportion of undocumented immigrants in the United States than Latinos. Yet the narrative is not about that. The continuing narrative that we hear in the U.S. landscape is that we are the model, that why can't you all be like them? And for us in the community, we're saying, oh my gosh, we're struggling. So for the young people today, the ideal of model minority, if you look at middle to upper class communities, that might resonate, right, for them. But if you look at the large proportion of Asian Pacific Islanders who struggle on a daily basis, it's kind of foreign to them, the idea of the model minority. I think what is still very salient today is that we are forever foreigners. So Mia Tuan, who is at University of Oregon, wrote a book called Model Minorities or Forever or Honorary Whites or Forever Foreigners. We are kind of depicted either or, right? Despite the fact that we've been in this continent since the 1500s, we are forever honorary whites or forever foreigners. And the idea of where do you come from, or where were you born, where were your parents really from, this continues today. The exotization or the exploitation of API bodies continues today. And so I think for young people, they may see Crazy Rich Asians, they may see Randall Park and Ali Wong's new movie, you know, as kind of an indicator of, wow, you know, like we're making a presence. But come on, is that all there is to Asian American narratives? It's we give sample little bits and pieces, API lives and API voices, ignoring the fact that we have been on the ground working with our partners of all communities of color forever. But we don't talk about that. So I think the young communities without Asian American studies or ethnic studies classes in K through 12, as well as in colleges, is a huge threat. If you look at among those who support anti-affirmative action views right now are Chinese Americans. And WeChat is the primary use of that. They use social media to really brainwash people. They're using that in a way to build this, you know, divide among our communities. And you wonder, like, why is it that Chinese immigrant communities are so anti-affirmative action? It's because they don't understand our history.
And WeChat is in Chinese. So those of us who are monolingual or who don't read or speak Chinese, which includes myself, we don't know what's being said. Yeah. But when I'm told what's said in WeChat, yeah, it's vile. Yeah. It's a new alternative, horrible, racist history that's being fed and actively fed by the far right.
We're going to talk more about that for sure. I want to come to Nolan real quick and ask you, because this issue of ethnic studies, and we've been talking a little bit about the importance of history, of having an accurate understanding of history when it comes to the API communities in our country. I think that sort of dovetails with a lot of your work. And as I said in the setup, you were an expert witness in the TUSD case involving La Raza Studies, Mexican American Studies, a program which many of you will know was banned by the state of Arizona at one point for being viciously anti-American and anti-white because it dared to teach accurate history about particularly Chicanx peoples. And eventually the courts have now ruled that that decision to shut down the program was unconstitutional. You were involved in that case. Talk a little bit about the connection that you see between the ways in which our ignorance of API histories and ignorance of Chicanx and broader Latinx histories sort of dovetail. What does what happened in Tucson, for instance, say about the way in which we come to these issues or the way in which powerful actors within state legislatures or within institutions like colleges and universities clearly are not interested in an accurate history of marginalized people? So what are the connections that you see between those?
So when it comes to ethnic studies, I think the first place to look is what happens in the absence of ethnic studies. And so when I interview white guys about issues of race on college campuses, the first thing that comes up when Asian Americans are brought up is that, well, they're not real minorities, or, you know, like black folk are, or Latinx folk are, or they're not really oppressed. And then the weird part about that is that it almost gives license to be overtly racist. It's sort of like it fits that trope of I'm not a racist, but. So I'd have like this one guy say, you know, hey, you know, going back to stereotypes, they're just, you know, they're just what they are. You know, they're kind of a reflection of reality, but they don't really harm people. At the same time, though, it has an inverted effect on a number of Asian American students on our college campuses. They start to internalize that belief as well. Like, even some of my more woke students at the U of A in the Asian American community, and not all of them, but some of them start to internalize that, like, well, you know, well, you have the Black Lives Matter, I'm sympathetic to that, there's border issues, I'm sympathetic to that, but, you know, as Asian Americans, we're really not that oppressed. I keep coming back to, I mean, a little point in history. In the Mexican American Studies case, the judge who ruled over it, Judge Wallace DeShima, was interned in Poston. This is not ancient history. This is stuff that's informing the here and now. And I think that that's really important because all of a sudden you have these students who don't really have a sense of where they are, who they are, any grounding in that. And it goes back to what the esteemed scholar Ronald Takaki said in his preface to A Different Mirror, where he said that what happens, to borrow from Adrian Rich, when someone with the authority of a teacher presents a history and you are not part of it, it is like looking into a mirror and seeing nothing, creating a psychic disequilibrium. And so therefore, ethnic studies creates that different mirror which people can see themselves in, and more importantly, we can tell an honest history of the country. And I think that's a really important component to it as well, that we have to be honest about history. There's sort of an irony of the way that we teach history right now where it's like, well, George Washington couldn't tell a lie. Well, that in and of itself is a lie. We can only lie about him not telling a lie. But the underlying point is that if we're really going to come together, and maybe that's the underlying issue, that if we tell an honest history and we link these oppressions and say that, yes, maybe the racialization of Asian Americans is different than the racialization of Latinx folks, which is different than the racialization of Black folk, which is different than the racialization of Native folk. But if we realize that they all are at the core are white supremacy and colonialism, that we actually create bonds and solidarity across our structures. We don't fall into the trap of the oppression Olympics and trying to say that my oppression is worse than yours. We actually see solidarity across those. And so I think that ethnic studies brings an incredibly incredible opportunity for that. And then just to get a little nerdy for a second, because folks always say, well, ethnic studies, it's, well, you're going to have, you know, increased balkanization, Black folk over here, white folk over here, brown folk over here. And actually, when you take ethnic studies, real ethnic studies, by the way, sorry, I need to do a plug about that. Heroes and Holidays and Foods and Fiestas doesn't do squat, okay? This is centering inequality and oppression historically, understanding its contemporary manifestations and strategizing what we can do about it, okay? Not this like, hey, you're different, I'm different, you know, you celebrate this holiday. No, that doesn't work. At the end of the day, once you do that, once you have a stronger sense of self from ethnic studies, which is a core component of it, again, seeing yourself in there, providing that different mirror, what ends up happening is the more secure you are, the more likely you are to interact across difference. It sounds really counterintuitive, but in many respects, by learning the specificities of our history, we're more likely to interact across difference. And so what's beautiful about that, though, is my dear friend and colleague, Jeff Milam, in the very first Mexican-American Studies trial, there were four of them, I think, he was put on the stand, and the Attorney General's office is coming after him. They're saying, isn't teaching this history, they had Occupied America, a foundational text in Chicano history. He said, isn't teaching this violent history of the U.S. Southwest and the takeover of Mexican lands by, they were basically white illegal immigrants, but that's a different issue. But the theft of that land, doesn't that promote resentment? Isn't that going to make our students, especially our Latinx students, our Mexican-American students in Tucson, isn't that going to make them resentful? And my colleague, he flipped it on its head and said, no, I actually think not teaching this history is what creates this resentment that we're dealing with right now. And I think that's at its core what we're talking about here, is that in order for us to unite, we actually need to understand our specificity and be okay with our uniqueness, and that makes us more likely to come together. Ethnic studies done well is an incredible opportunity to do that. And what's been beautiful about it is, in some respects, we're kind of having a resurgence of the 60s movement as youth-led coalitions are advocating for ethnic studies throughout the country. We had that here in Portland Public Schools. We're having that all throughout the state of California and Washington and Nevada. The only place that we really haven't had it, a resurgence, is back in Tucson, even though that's the example that everybody points to. I think that the biggest thing that we need to do right now is not just advocate for ethnic studies, but make sure that it's meaningful ethnic studies. Ethnic studies done well is one of the most promising educational advancements of the last half century. And you don't have to take my word for it. That was actually the statistician on behalf of the state of Arizona who was meant to rebuke me in the Mexican-American Studies trial. He said that on the stand, that this is he didn't believe my stats, but he said, if this is true, if these stats are true about Mexican-American studies, it's one of the most important educational advancements of the last half century. So take that to heart as we're talking about ethnic studies, that this is the future, this is our way forward as we're progressing, not just as a community, but as locales and in education.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. David, so your work focuses heavily on the way that stereotypes have been historically used and are still used and replicated in popular culture, in media, and in society more broadly. When we think of stereotypes, though, and this is something that Helen sort of briefly touched on as well, we do tend to think of stereotypes as these viciously, obviously, overtly negative characterizations of groups. And yet, as Helen mentioned, there is sort of this weird permutation when it comes to stereotypes of Asian American and Pacific Islander folks as these quote-unquote positive stereotypes, which of course, as Helen noted, are not positive. There are other groups historically that have been characterized in similar ways. Talk a little bit about, as an expert on the way stereotypes have been deployed and the damage they do, why should we be just as concerned about, well, actually, two questions. One, what's the connection between these overtly hostile negative stereotypes and these supposedly positive ones of other groups? And then secondly, why should we be just as concerned about the deployment of so-called positive stereotypes as we are of the obviously negative and hostile ones?
A couple of things. One, I enjoyed listening. The problem with being on a panel is, at least for me, is I get so wrapped up in what everyone else is saying, I forget what I'm going to say. First, I'm thinking of, I grew up in Mobile, Alabama. I was born in Harlem, but I grew up in Mobile, all-black neighborhood. And whenever I think of stereotypes, I think I had a colleague, a friend, a brother of sorts who spent, and this is a poor black neighborhood, this is Pritchett, Alabama, Highway 45. He spent his time thinking about time and space. And when he was on a basketball court, we told him, you don't belong on this court. Every time you shoot a basketball, you kill a stereotype. That's supposed to be funny. Putting a label that characterizes any group in some single dimension way, it's not just inaccurate, it's just silly. And if you're a sane person, you know better than that. So that's the first point I want to make about stereotypes. They're just that, for lack of a better term, they're silly. And before I forget it, I want to say something about history. If you don't like so-called black history and red history and yellow history, there's a, just do it right. And then we won't have these other histories. That's the first piece. I was giving a session to some honor students in the state of Michigan. They presented as whites. And I bring out objects. And so one of the objects is from the so-called Tojo caricature of Japanese Americans. And it's vile and vulgar. And it's a costume sold in Walmart for $15.75. The reason I mention the price is because that's so cheap that it's accessible. You know what I mean? It's not like the average person couldn't pay for it. So I took up the costume, and it's got the, you know, the fang teeth, and it's just a really horrific piece. And so I show this to the students, and we're in a cabin, just us. I show the costume, and I say, so how many of you believe this is offensive? And most of them raise their hands. And then I said, and how many of you believe it's racist? And only about a fourth of them raised their hands. And so I said to them, what would it take to make this obviously caricatured, you know, depiction of what someone perceived to be an Asian American, what would it take to make this offensive thing racist? And almost in unison, like a Greek chorus, they said, make it black. And I was like, man, that shit is so deep. And so we talk, you know, I was like, why would it have to be black to be racist? So we spent the better part of the next day just trying to deal with that. So a couple other quick points. One, about the model minority idea. There's another part of that which suggests that they're a model in part because their success is not owed in any meaningful way to protest. That they weren't screaming and yelling and demanding. They were just working hard. That is offensive on so many levels. But again, it's actually not even accurate. Right. Okay? The other part is this. It made me think, there is a certain arrogance in telling people how to grieve and address the injustices which are meted out against them. Mm-hmm. That's just flat out arrogance. So even if I don't like the way people protest, it's not my protest. They're addressed. They shouldn't have to address it, mm-hmm. but they're addressed. So I want to make mention of that. And then quickly, I live in Michigan, and we had a white supremacist picnic. Now, I'm on white supremacist listservs and websites and stuff. So they were doing a picnic, and the picnic was advertised. It was fascinating. This whole racial formation thing in the U.S. is just, it basically advertised for people who were mostly white. And I thought to myself, multiculturalism has come to the white supremacists. You know? Because there ain't enough white people left, you know what I mean? To so it's like,
yeah.
It's like if you're just presenting as white, and then it made me a little sad because I used to have this really naive idea. And if you do this work, you have to have some naivete. I mean, it's an innocence. You have to be a dogged fighter and all the other stuff, but you also have to dream. And so one of my ideas was that if we could force, coerce, encourage, whatever, every single American into receiving a DNA test, that it would eliminate white supremacy. And once I saw that picnic flyer, I realized that white supremacists will find a way to be white. And every DNA test is not going to help that at all. So in the museum, Tim, back to your stereotype, we collect pieces on all groups. The Jim Crow Museum obviously is primarily dealing with anti-black pieces, but we collect all pieces. We take seriously Martin Luther King's famed, although I wish people would read the whole thing, Injustice Anywhere is a Threat to Justice Everywhere. And I'll give you this sad account, which is when I first started telling many of my colleagues that I was going to start collecting pieces, two-dimensional and three-dimensional objects that defamed Asian Americans, gay Americans, Latino, just these other groups, they didn't like it. They said that it would dilute the purpose of what we were doing, but we did it anyway because for this house of hell, there are many rooms, but it's still a house of hell.
Mm, thank you. So I want to throw open this question a little bit about divide and conquer, and I want to expand it a little because it strikes me that part of the divide and conquer in the way that Asian American and Pacific Islander communities are racialized isn't just that they are used to divide them from, let's say, African Americans or Latinx peoples or indigenous peoples, but literally there's also a divide and conquer within the 20 plus Asian and Pacific Islander community. So when we think of the Harvard case, we are talking about, according to the data, as Helen alluded to earlier, we're talking about a very narrow substrata of Asian peoples in this country, not representative of the larger whole. In fact, not only at Harvard, you may not know this, but in highly selective colleges and universities generally, the Asian American folks who are applying and getting into those schools, not only are they not representative of the larger country, they're not representative of Asian Americans. They are disproportionately upper income. They are disproportionately likely to have net assets over $200,000 a year. That is not at all typical for the Asian American community as a whole. And so we're talking about a very narrow group. It is disproportionately also ethnically and nationally a handful of those 20-some-odd groups. It is disproportionately Japanese Americans, Chinese Americans, occasionally Filipino peoples, but a handful of, or South Asian Indian communities as well represented, but it's usually not, very rarely is it, Vietnamese, Thai, Cambodian, Lao, Hmong. And so we have a lot of Asian peoples being left out of that conversation altogether. How does the use of this model minority concept not only divide Asian peoples and harm, let's say, Black and Latinx peoples who were then typified as the very not model minorities, but how does it also hurt Asians?
All of the speakers have talked about being seen as the same and how that is just harmful in any way. Mary was talking about on college campuses, and one of the harms is if you're seen as being, you know, the perfect model, A, that means your expectation is you're going to be perfect. You're going to be the top of your class. Mm-hmm. What if you're not? What if you're not good at math? And, you know, I'm one of those. You know, and what if you have a problem and you can't even identify that because you're not supposed to have a problem? That's incredible pressure. And I wonder how many of you here know that on college campuses today, the number one group that is committing suicide are Asian Americans, and especially Asian American girls. Mm-hmm. And it's a silent epidemic, and even within the Asian American community, it's not talked about. People, you know, because of course you're a model, you can't have this happening. Mm-hmm. And then, should they get scholarships? Why? They're all rich. And one of the things is if you start to disaggregate all this stuff, you see that, well, that's number one, not true across the board, but also, you know, most of the income data that's available, the easiest stuff to take a slice of is the household income. Now, if you actually start breaking that down and looking geographically, most Asian Americans actually live in urban areas, you know, around urban areas, and incomes are higher in urban areas. And so if you take that and household, mm-hmm. a lot of Asian households are large, and many people in the household work. So that actually, if you look at a per capita income, and then if you looked at it geographically and compared it, it's quite different. Mm-hmm. And so all of those things are, you know, just so. And so what is the harm when you say that? Well, Asian American communities, they don't, their models, they don't have domestic violence. You know, they don't have family stress. They don't have crime within their own communities. There's no poverty. There are seniors, you know, they take care of themselves. They don't need health care. And so actually, you know, some of the, New York City, I was just seeing a new information about that, is that the group that has the racial group at the highest poverty level in New York is Asian Americans, mm-hmm. which I have to say I was surprised at. Because even for people who pay attention to this stuff, if it's not out there and you know, if it's not on social media, if it's not on the news, you know, as we see it out there in the world, did it really exist? You know, and the problem I see for Asian Americans is, you know, we don't define ourselves. We haven't reached that capacity to be able to do that, or that level of power or self-empowerment to be able to tear down these images, stereotypes that exist for us. And if there isn't real ethnic studies for all of our groups and self-awareness, then what gets put in the void between our ears? It's that junk that comes across that we've been brainwashed with from the time that we're babies. Hollywood, you know, the bigger media, and that's how we end up seeing each other, which is, boy, is that the greatest way to keep us all divided. So the harm is great. I mean, I am active in a lot of different Asian community stuff and around family violence, for example. One of the biggest challenges for shelters for Asian American women, who for the most part are young immigrant women who don't have access, their spouses or significant others who maybe are controlling them also have their passports and visas. They have nowhere to go. But these shelters don't actually have any way of getting funding for the most part because this doesn't exist in the Asian community. I was real involved in anti-hate crimes work in Michigan with the hate crime against Vincent Chin in the 1980s. And by the way, that was an example of races, classes, religions across the board coming together to fight hate violence and working to create the hate crimes protection laws that exist today. That part, nobody knows about. The examples of people coming together from all walks of life to actually make change, we don't hear enough of that. The harm is that, you know, in tracking hate crimes against all groups, but particularly here with Asian Americans after the hate crime against Vincent Chin, the number one thing that happens if there is a hate crime against an Asian American is that law enforcement says, oh, well, Asian Americans don't experience race. There's no racism against Asian Americans, so how could it possibly be a hate crime? And incident after incident after incident, you know, a guy on a subway train mm-hmm. who's just going home, you know, after a long day work, has some other, a white guy with an egg roll, come and take that egg roll and shove it into the man's face saying, hey, egg roll, hey, egg roll, and then stabs him to death. And so the police response to that is, well, that's not a hate crime. Egg roll's not a racial slur. You know, and so there are incidents and incidents over and over again like that. That is the harm of just not, you know, being seen as real people and as full human beings. W.E.B. Du Bois said throughout the black newspapers and African-American communities of the day in the 1800s, he said, the Chinese Exclusion Act is not good for America. Now, here's a leading black intellectual who is saying something about the Asian Americans and saying this is bad for America and for the black community. And how many Asian Americans know that, or any of us, or how the great grape boycott that was led by Cesar Chavez, you know, I mean, that was also initiated and with full participation by Filipino American farm workers. And the Equal Rights Amendment, the first state in the union to pass the Equal Rights Amendment for women was Hawaii. And that effort was led by Patsy Mink, the first woman of color in Congress. And she reached out across, you know, the race divide to Shirley Chisholm and Gloria Steinem. And, you know, the way women are kept divided by saying, oh, feminists, that's a white thing. Or a gay lesbian, well, that's a white thing. And so speaking of how we're divided, when same-sex marriage came up, the first target to keep people against gay marriage, lesbian marriage, the black, Asian, Latino communities were targeted. So that, because it's why, you know, communities of color don't have gay people. And so, you know, the right wing made a beeline to communities of color to try to keep people divided that way. It's smart. This Harvard lawsuit, I actually went and sat in one of the sessions. They talk about implicit bias. Mm-hmm. They talk about all of the things that most people don't get taught in school or ethnic studies because it doesn't exist. And they talked about it. Mm-hmm. And so you could imagine being an Asian American who, as Mary was talking about, don't come here without knowledge of the history of their own communities. Mm-hmm. And they hear this group saying, yeah, these are ways, implicit bias that's used against you. Well, you know, that's pretty strong, you know, honey to people who say, well, nobody else is seeing who we are. Mm-hmm. And so that harms all of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Anyone else want to hop in on that?
You know, I want to just kind of echo, you know, Helen's call for disaggregating the data. Beyond the very divisive nature of the narrative that's framed at the Harvard Law, I think, you know, what my esteemed colleague over here talked about with the costuming, you know, the only way it would be racist if it was black. I think it's people don't respond when we see hate toward API communities. I ask all of you in this room to respond when you see hate, discrimination, racist comments, microaggression toward API communities. Even though APIs, in one of the Pew reports, that we're the rise of Asian American immigrants, right, we're the fastest growing immigrant population in the United States, we're still smaller in number. We need allies. Asian Americans have always been a part of the coalition building for black communities, for Latino communities. We need allies as well. And I think the thing that APIs don't do well is to get angry. You know, I love to talk about Phil Yu and his Angry Asian Man blog because it's about staying angry. We need to be pissed off. The model minority framework is we're submissive, we're docile, we're hardworking, we're family oriented. Yes, some of us are. But some of us are really pissed off, right? And I think the thing is there's nothing wrong with being angry. In fact, why aren't you angry when you see these horrible things that are done, vicious things like the egg roll stabbing, but also subtle things where people are always doing the slant eye and they don't understand why that's offensive. These subtle microaggressive jokes are really a cover-up for overt racist sentiments. Mm-hmm. And it is a way for Asian Americans who have to internalize racist ideologies because they did not see themselves in the media, they do not see themselves in history book, they don't even see themselves in their communities at times, that they have to think because of the internment, because of the exclusion line, that we have to be American. And to be American means to shed our cultural ethnic identity. And so there are people who do feel that way because of the pressure to make it in this country. And that is wrong. I wanted to share that, you know, Helen grew up in the East Coast. We have someone who grew up in Detroit, Michigan, and Alabama, yes. Right? I grew up in San Francisco. I'm an immigrant. I'm a 1.5 generation. I immigrated when I was 6 years old. I didn't speak a lick of English. If people smiled at me when they spoke, I said yes. If they frowned when they spoke, I said no. Because I had no idea what they were saying. But I knew that in San Francisco, when I immigrated in the 70s, is that the people who look most like me, because there were very few APIs at the time, were African Americans and Latinos. And that was kind of my core identity, right? And so I think when you see, you know, the embracing of hip-hop culture among API communities, and people are saying, like, they're appropriating blackness, for some of us who grew up in the neighborhoods, that's our community. right? So when I moved to different areas, I had to realize I can't look at my, you know, fellow Black communities and give them the nod, or, you know, because they looked at me like, what are you doing? Like, you know, you're trying to be like us. And I'm like, but that was my community. And so for APIs, we are constantly having to navigate our social terrains depending on where we grow up and where we live. And it's a challenge, and it's confusing, right? So it's not surprising that we have such, you know, death by suicide, you know, among API young women. It's not surprising that we have, you know, communities who are fighting against each other, very much like in the early 80s and 90s of African-American communities fighting against each other. And it's just a different realm. It's a different way of fighting. It's fighting for that position for some to be honorary whites, and many of us who are fighting to say, come on, let's dismantle that.
Nolan, David?
So a couple of thoughts. A lot of the big topics have already been covered in wonderful depth, but I think that in terms of Asian Americans and disaggregation, the need to disaggregate is very prevalent just in the Harvard case itself. Because Ed Blum, this affirmative action hater, has been sitting there intentionally trying to do not just a court trial, but or file a lawsuit, but also trying to win in the court of public opinion. And if you look at the headlines, he's largely effective at doing it, because every hackneyed headline says, Asian Americans suing Harvard. And we don't ask the obvious question, like, all of them?
Right.
And I think one of the big things that we need to be able to do right now is to call BS on that. And to be able to say no, that call out the intentional political strategy, to call out the way that it's meant to divide Asian American communities versus all other racialized minorities, and to call it out as an act of white supremacy in the way that he's engaging in this work. But ultimately, that trope of the lack of disaggregation within Asian America in the larger discourse regarding Asian Americans is exactly what he's playing off of. Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that's extraordinarily troubling for me, because again, it gets back to that issue that that Asian Americans as a whole aren't suffering in some way. And going back to the research on college campuses, and when students internalize this notion of we're not really the oppressed, we're not real minorities, what ends up happening is that when you have these interpersonal examples of white supremacy in the form of microaggressions, social policies, the complete lack of engagement that a university will have towards academic engagement, academic support for these communities, what ends up happening is The ideology pacifies the student population. It doesn't. They don't say no. This is what we're entitled to. You know, because there's a weird thing about millennials that there's this discourse that millennials are so entitled. They're so entitled. And actually, I kind of flipped that on its head, and I say that so many of our students have been told that, you know, the civil rights movement happened and things are getting better. They don't feel entitled to safe spaces on campus. They don't feel entitled to not being the subject of racial microaggressions, and they accommodate that. And what ends up happening is you psychologically put that on yourself. And I remember when the Michigan case, the Grutter and Grant's affirmative action cases were coming up, there was a town hall at the University of Michigan, and they started introducing the concept of microaggressions. I mean, and you know, 16 years ago, that was really, really groundbreaking. And so many students were breaking down for the precise reason that they said, you gave a name to my pain. I had internalized this. I had put it on myself. I had said, these are my friends. They couldn't possibly be being racist. You have to hate people to be racist. You have to be an overt white supremacist to be hate. You have to be like David Duke to be racist. They're not being racist because that would be a bad thing. They're bad people. No, they're good people, so they're not racist. And you start to internalize it, and you don't have any outlet for it. And then by naming it and then saying, no, it's not that you're seeing the world accurately. It's actually them that are being messed up. That's an important thing psychologically, so that the stress psychologically can be relieved from our students. And so that's why it's so important to both call BS on the myth of the model minority, as well as saying call for the need to disaggregate, because once you start getting to disaggregation, you start to understand where the pain is occurring. And you don't just do this weird sort of social synecdoche where elite Chinese becomes emblematic of all Asian American. Instead, we're actually able to see the nuances and understand where people are struggling and understand where people are being harmed.
David?
A couple things. One, I used to teach American minorities, and I would ask my students, I'd show a picture of Michael Chang, and I would say, using the vernacular of the area, so what is he? And people would say, He's Chinese. He's second generation American. I'd show a picture of Andre Agassi, and I'd say, so what is he? And they'd say, he's an American. I think he's second generation Iranian American. And then I'd show a picture of Pete Sampras, and I'd say, so what is he? And they go, he's an American. I go, well, he's first generation American. So you don't have to be a sociologist to figure out what's going on in those stories, where whiteness is just a synonym for America. So part of this, we're chipping away at that. Two, I go to presentations all the time where they make the business argument for diversity. And it basically means there's more of them and more of them are coming, and we better accommodate them. If we can't figure out a better way to do it, we better accommodate the fact that they're coming. I sit in those meetings thinking to myself, these numbers are scaring the hell out of people. They're not pleased with the numbers, right? Number three, I don't want us to lose sight of this. I'm an activist in my heart. This is the U.S. I want. I want a U.S. where little children don't go to sleep at night crying because they're not white. And everything flows from that.
Thank you. Before we take some questions, I just wanted to add one thing as sort of a ending framing on my end. One of the ways that we know that this model minority trope is functionally white supremacist and is a tool of white supremacy is, I think, was driven home for me most obviously many years ago when I started going around and speaking around the country. I remember, and at first I was surprised by this, and then I came to sort of go, oh, I understand what's going on. I would give speeches up in the Pacific Northwest in those early days. I would come to Washington State often, and I would come to Oregon. And for a while, everywhere I went, I was being followed around, and it still happens occasionally, but I was being followed around by white supremacist, I mean, overt ones, not like just the average everyday ones that we all have on our campuses. I mean, like actual Nazis, right? And they would come to my talks, and they usually would not disrupt. These were very polite, erudite Nazis, and they would come and they would sit in the rooms and they would ask questions. And now you would think, if you're a Nazi, and this might be hard for us to imagine, but this, like, imagine that you're a Nazi and you've got this guy up in front of you who's making this argument about institutional racism and about white supremacy. You would think you'd probably get up and ask a question to try to, you know, prove the superiority of the white race. Or maybe you would attack me because you know I'm Jewish and so you're going to go off about the Jews, this, that, and the other. Every time that they would ask a question, it would not be about that. It would not be about, look how superior white people are, even though you know that's what they think. They would always ask a question about, well, if racism is really such a big deal, why are Asian folks doing so well in this country? Now, why would a Nazi who doesn't give two shits about Asian people, right? Why would a Nazi want to make that their art? They could have asked any question in the world. They could have made any point in the world, but they wanted to say, what about Asians? And yet you know they don't have any love for Asian folk. You know that is a tool that they are using, because what does it do? It allows them to say, even me, a Nazi, can't possibly be a white supremacist because I'm telling you how great Asian folks are. So you're just using it as a rhetorical device to essentially give you a coat of armor against the charge of being a racist. So let's just understand, you know, to me, those quote-unquote positive stereotypes are always coming with a backhanded slap. And so I'll leave it at that. If you have questions, please come to the microphone. Thank you all for joining us today for the show.
Tim?
Yeah.
I did want to mention, you know, in relation to the Nazis and Asian Americans, remember the Charlottesville march, there was one Asian American in the march. I don't know if you noticed that. Yeah. And if you look at the Get Out movie, there was one Asian American. So it's really interesting when you look at the framing of reality and also what Hollywood depicts, because people would say, in Get Out, why was there that one Asian American? For those of us who understand the history, we know where there was that one, right? And so I think be much more observant about what you see out there in terms of how we are positioned and to pit against various communities of color.
Yes.
My name is Rodney Stark. I go to Orange Coast College in Southern California. I just want to say thank you for your time and all the information. I really wanted to ask you guys, do you believe, you know, in the spirit of solidarity and, like you said, the real history that American descendants of slaves are entitled to reparations? And I kind of want to hear from each of you what that may look like and how you guys may see it.
The short answer for me is yeah, of course. I mean, Cogs and Shapiro did an amazing analysis of wealth along racial lines and showing that, you know, because there's a difference between income and wealth. So, you know, because if you don't have wealth, you can't get a loan. You can't, you know. And so they also did an analysis where they said that basically the what's owed to descendants of slaves compounded with interest is basically more money than we've ever had in our country ever. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the short answer is, of course, there has to be something there. Mm-hmm. The logistics of it, that's something that's a little bit beyond my pay grade. But the point is, it's more for me, it's more like just getting it into the public discourse, like trying to get the Green New Deal and have people who can actually work it on a policy level. But yeah, because it would have to probably be a multi-pronged approach, not just monetary, but also an affirmative action program. I mean, a great way to do that would be look at all the people who've been incarcerated as a result of the war on drugs and focus on them as weed is legalized everywhere. Mm-hmm. Those are the communities that should be running the show off of that. And I know it's kind of conflating different issues all at the same time, but in some respects, it's all part of the same historical trajectory.
Yeah.
I would also argue the answer is yes. I've spoken pretty openly and written about the sort of moral case for reparations since the early 2000s, and I'm very heartened that it's now a mainstream discourse conversation, however uncomfortable it is for a lot of people. I'm a lot like Nolan in the sense that I don't know policy-wise how it looks, but I think that, you know, something that, you know, John Conyers was trying for years to get even just a study. I mean, it is congressman's, you know, it was the first bill that would be filed every year. All he wanted was a study to try to figure out how do we do this, mm-hmm. right? And it never got out of committee. They didn't even want to study. We study everything in this country, right? We'll commission a study for anything, but they wouldn't study that, which tells you a lot, right? Because they don't want whatever answer is going to come. Yeah. At the very least, we ought to be committed to figuring out some possible trajectories of what it might look like. My argument would be, and it's not really mine to make per se, and it's certainly not mine to overdetermine what it would look like. I think that because white supremacy and racism are systemic problems, the solutions must also be systemic. Yeah. And what I mean by that is it will not, in my estimation, be sufficient or even helpful to simply have reparations be about checks being written to individuals, because the injury was not individual, the injury was collective. So when I conceive of it, I think of something along the lines of, frankly, what we did for our enemies after World War II, which was help rebuild, right? In other words, we spent billions of dollars to rebuild places that we had been bombing. And then in the United States, you know, we did similar things. The Homestead Act, which gave out 220 million acres of free land to essentially only white people in the 1860s. We've done these kinds of huge programs before. We did after the Depression and shortly thereafter, we spent billions to create the white middle class with FHA loans, VA loans, the GI Bill. All of that stuff that we've done for some, we haven't done for those who were uniquely and specifically injured by this system. And what we know from those other efforts is, what did they do? They stimulated the economy. They were good for everyone. Like, you know, not in equal measure. They didn't trickle down, obviously, but it helped the economy to spend money to create that white middle class. Mm-hmm. Imagine how much would then benefit everyone if we did the same for those who have been affected by the legacy of slavery and white supremacy. So, again, we have to talk about what it would look like, but there's absolutely no question that a moral and philosophical principle is at stake, and I think the answer is yes.
No, I ditto and echo both of my colleagues' statements, you know, because I think beyond the monetary aspect, we have to have institutional and structural change, right? Mm-hmm. So, and that's just, you know, consistent with this panel, such a huge, huge hurdle, but not impossible if we all work together, mm-hmm. yeah.
Yes to all of that, and to say that there's a precedent yes. to that, which is the redress and reparations that went to Japanese Americans mm-hmm. who were incarcerated during World War II. And that was a check of $20,000 to those who were still alive, you know, years later. So if your family lost everything, but the, you know, the grandparents who were there are now deceased, you didn't get anything. But here's the one thing that also came out of the individual checks was that the communities that fought for this also said it's beyond individuals. Money has to be set aside for education. So a few million dollars were set aside for a fund that funded authors, they funded researchers, they funded filmmakers, so that a lot of the story now about what happened to mostly American citizens who were locked up. It has now been captured. So there has to also, in thinking of what this would be, you know, the systemic change and also the teaching change.
So yes, and yes to all of that. But I have my eyes on a specific 40 acres.
I feel you.
Indeed, indeed.
Hello, my name is Francis. I am a senior going into, at Iowa State University, going into my senior year. I'm someone who identifies as an Asian American, and I guess I wanted to get kind of your insight or your advice or your personal experiences about navigating kind of those tough conversations with other Asian Americans that perpetuate microaggressions or have those conversations where they align with values of white supremacy, whether it's through family, friends, or even online through folks that are aware, like subtle Asian traits and online forums like that. Okay. So just kind of your personal experiences of how you navigated that stuff.
I'll start with just this first piece. I used to try to do big group discussions. And what I discovered was that I'd get narratives, like sometimes hero narratives, where the person speaking is the hero of the narrative. And it was just a lot of, I don't want to say emptiness, but we couldn't get places. And I thought, why is that the case? Because people don't know that they're going to get another chance to talk, mm-hmm. right? And so they try to get everything out. So what I've tried to do is work in small groups. And for me, real work is often done when there's like 8, 6, 8, 10, 12 people where they're dedicated. And then we just set some simple rules. Number one, you can't hit people, all right? That's a real thing, though, right? And by hit people, I don't just mean physically hit people, right? And that we listen. It's okay to push people. And there's a real difference between something being safe and something being uncomfortable. I believe in a thing can be uncomfortable and still safe. And then the final part I've learned, and it took me a long time to learn this, you can't crush people if you're trying to grow them or help them grow or help them help you grow. You can't crush them because once you crush them, they're gone. You can't teach them. You can't be a part of a teaching moment with them. I didn't say you can't push them and push them hard and push them with passion. I didn't say that, but you can't crush them. Not only can you not teach them if you crush them, you can't teach people that witness the crushing. And so part of this is just me, the higher ed person, who believes in the triumph of dialogue, who believes that people can get to a place. But we have to start with the understanding that it's hard and it's okay that it's hard.
I would also add to what David said is to not feel discouraged. I mean, we're talking about everybody who's grown up in this country and beyond drinking all this poison and also becoming, in a way, self-hating, too, mm-hmm. and in denial. Mm-hmm. I've had so many conversations with other Asian Americans and other non-Asians, too, about, oh, I've never experienced racism. I've never experienced sexism. But then when you start talking to them, and to the point of small groups and one-on-one, at some point there may be something where somebody says, yeah, you know, all my life working for this company, 30 years, I have trained every mm-hmm. wet behind the ears mm-hmm. college white boy to be my boss. Mm-hmm. And it hurt. Mm-hmm. It always hurt. Mm-hmm. And they don't call it racism because Asian Americans are not supposed to experience mm-hmm. racism. Mm-hmm. But at some point, the feelings might come out. But you have to not be discouraged because people come at understanding at their own time. Mm-hmm. And I've had friends who, when I was in college, would say, you care about that, I don't. You go to that event, don't bug me anymore. And I stayed friends. And then when they have their own kids, call me up and say, you know, I'm worried about my boy because he's in school and I think he's really feeling low self-esteem because he's Asian. Mm-hmm. And then she says, can you recommend any books for me? And I resist the urge to say, you should have gone to those events back then. But, you know, yeah. People come at it at their own time.
So in terms of group dialogue within the Asian American community. Obviously, it's a little beyond my pay grade, but within the Latinx community, I think that there are some parallels. And especially this locale is very personal to me. I grew up on 51st and Taylor's Ferry, and split time between there and McMinnville. This was before Portland was Portlandia. It was just a quirky place with a lot of white folk. And it's really disheartening how many internalized stereotypes Mexican-Americans would have about our own communities. Like, if I'm not choloed out, I'm not authentically Mexican.
Right.
Which, a cholo doesn't mean anything in Mexico, but that's a different issue altogether.
Right.
And so, you know, I was a very good student growing up, but at the same time, that would be used against me. You can't be Chicano because you're too smart. Mm-hmm. You know, but then folks at the lower end of the spectrum, at the lower end of the school and the lower track, would internalize the negative beliefs about our own community. Mm-hmm. We're not going anywhere. I'm just gonna be a mechanic. And I hate talking like that. I'm trying to, because I don't want to demean mechanics. I want to say it was more that there was a tone that they were using with it, that my life is not going anywhere because I'm a brown dude in McMinnville, because I'm a brown dude in Portland. The point being that ethnic studies as a whole can be a great opportunity for that. And a lot of what I think we're kind of talking about here is almost interpersonal ethnic studies. Collective, like, we don't have to have education only going on in a school. We can collectively learn about ourselves and our collective histories and not be reliant upon teachers and formal educators in order to do it, that we can be the ones who do that for ourselves. And in that respect, we can collectively disrupt white supremacy, and not just white supremacy from white folks against us, but also white supremacy that we have internalized.
Thank you very much. Next question, please.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Ruby Hunsra. I am from Seattle Central College. I have another inward-facing question, like the last one. I guess the void that I felt in this dialogue today was more along the lines of, as Asian Americans, the privilege that we do have and the hate that our communities have towards the black body. I don't know that was addressed. And I think it's important in this context. So I'd like to hear each of your views on that. Thank you.
Thank you for that question. I think, you know, I personally feel, and I've been teaching on this quite a bit, is the need to decolonize our minds. You know, it has a lot to do with the colonization that many of our Asian Americans have faced, from our immigrant parents, even in this continent as well, in the Pacific. And I think when we look at the neocolonial state and the imperial power in the United States that continues to haunt us, we have been taught and socialized to really hate ourselves. And the lighter we are, the better, right? And so the colorism among not just Asian American, but Latino communities, African American communities, is really the need to decolonize the way we think about our bodies, our communities. And without that, I think that's gonna continue to go on. For the longest time, women, Asian American women or Asian women who marry black men, were demonized and taught to be like prostitutes. Right, that they were not real Asian and they shamed the family. It was still bad with white men, but even more so with black and brown communities. So I think it's a larger conversation, and I think it has to do with the legacy of war. It has to do with the legacy of colonization, and I think it has to do with the white supremacy that we've talked about.
And I would just jump in and say real quickly that I think the anti-blackness piece, for any community that is particularly, let's say, post-Exclusion Act immigrant communities, and also for anyone whose populations are largely immigrant populations who come to this country, mm-hmm. anti-blackness is one of our principal products.
Yeah.
And every group that has come here, right, is it mm-hmm. learns very quickly.
Right.
I mean, this is just the psychology of power mm-hmm. is mm-hmm. when I get to your place and I
right.
see what the power dynamic is, mm-hmm. I can either align with the bottom or the top.
Right.
The Irish did this. When the Irish came to America, they were told explicitly by their leaders in Ireland mm-hmm. that they were to come and join the abolition struggle because they had been the slaves of the British. They were right. told in no uncertain terms they are to join that struggle because that is where their alliances should be. Well, the Irish got here and some did join the struggle, but you know what a lot of others did? They looked around and they were like, holy hell, we're not gonna throw down with these people. Mm-hmm. We're gonna go burn the black orphanage on 42nd Street mm-hmm. in New York City at the beginning of the draft riots just to show mm-hmm. how anti-black we are. Mm-hmm. Like so it's not at all shocking mm-hmm. that anti-blackness would be, you know, Malcolm X said the first word that all immigrants learn, we know what the word is, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm not gonna say it, but he did, and you know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. That it's a product and mm-hmm. we sell it. And so it becomes internalized. It becomes a way to step over people. There's nothing shocking. It probably has versions that happen in other countries with other communities. But in this country, that's a principal product that we have to address.
Mm-hmm. And those Irish also painted their faces black.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And mm-hmm. which is kind of interesting, to paint your face black, to pretend to be black in order to earn your whiteness.
Right. I just want to add, just for the podcast and also for those of you who are here, who are interested in the affirmative action conversation, to look to Janelle Wong, who's at University of Maryland, who's written just quite a bit about this debate, as well as Uyen Phun, who's at University of Colorado. So, you know, look,
Colorado State.
Yeah, and so they've been, Colorado State. So yeah, they've been working on this for a long, long time. And so I would really encourage you to look up a lot of the reports that they've written on affirmative action in Asian Americans.
And also, Oyan's page has the affirmative action syllabus. So if you want to educate yourself, there's just a whole host of references there.
Yeah.
And so, you know, people say, well, where can I learn about it? There it is.
It's right there.
Google affirmative action syllabus. It'll pop right up.
Yeah.
Right.
Hello, my name is Alex Kasson. I go to Butler University in the state of Indiana, predominantly white, liberal private institution. And I'll be a senior this year, and in my past 3 years, I've sat on probably 11 committees for something D&I related in one way or another. And the number one thing that I'm facing from students, whether it's mentoring or just working alongside them, is that we're all experiencing fatigue, and we're all really tired already. Mm-hmm. And as a majority of the people in this room can speak to, we're probably just getting started in the grand scheme of things. And so I'm sort of curious, what does it look like to do this work sustainably? How do I stay educated? How do I make sure that I'm being a resource for others when looking at the media, looking at the news can be traumatizing and re-traumatizing? But sort of how do we buckle down for the long haul and stay in it and stay in the fight when we're already exhausted? I guess that's the question. Thank you.
I won't give an overarching statement to it, but I will say that one of the biggest things that myself and a lot of my colleagues deal with is just guilt. If I'm not engaged, you know, the status quo of white supremacy is perpetuated, and how can I abide by that? It's become sort of our trope of going back to Audre Lorde, where she said that taking care of yourself is not self-indulgence, it's self-preservation, and therefore an act of political warfare. Mm-hmm. And it becomes our mantra. We have to keep telling each other that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the big thing, is telling each other that, because when we isolate ourselves, we forget that. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, here's the next crisis, the next crisis, the next crisis. And all of a sudden, we're completely worn down. Mm-hmm. But by reminding ourselves about that and that it is the long struggle, it helps us get beyond that guilt. Because we're in Arizona. We're like, how can you not be outraged by kids in cages and Border Patrol on campus and, you know, Border Patrol dumping out water that was meant for migrants just so that they can live? You know, how can we not be outraged by the guy who, you know, the list of outrage that's very justifiable and warranted is important. But the thing is, if we don't recharge our batteries, if we don't take that time just to go up to Mount Lemmon and just take a day just to refocus, we become ineffective in the long run.
Yeah, in addition to guilt, I would throw in optimism. And because, well, number one, to what Nolan said, it is a long haul. But the thing about it is to know that we're talking about history. History moves in cycles. There is, as the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King said, the long arc of history bends toward justice. And I would just add to that, if we help it bend. And so we're not alone, number one. To recharge is to always know that there are other people around you who give you support, who are working for the same things, who have your back when you need to take a rest, and that you'll do the same for them when they need to have a rest. But to know that all this shit is going to change. Mm-hmm. You know, this is happening today because the white supremacists and, you know, all those folks suddenly woke up and realized that this trend that's been going on for more than 50 years, hey, it's happening. And they cannot put that genie back in the bottle. That change is coming. So how are we going to be prepared to not let all of this stuff that they're throwing at us to keep us from moving forward? So what we do today is going to make a difference, every one of us, but it's going to take every one of us too.
So my name is Kim. I'm from the University of Washington. Not too long ago, Washington State passed this legislature for affirmative action. So now we have affirmative action. It's called I-1000 in Washington State. But the group that tried to repeal I-1000 is called Washington's Equality for Asians. And I went to the debriefing for an event that occurred based on white supremacists. It was a UW Republican group where they had a bake sale. And at this bake sale, they put a price tag for different races. Asians are $1.50. Native Americans are free. African Americans are 50 cents. And white people are $1. So I went to the debrief, and I sit in the circle with other POCs. And I wanted to reflect on my positionality as well as reflect on this feeling that Asians may or may not feel, but I felt it at the time. Like, why do I always prove that I'm a POC, especially in these types of circles? But my question to you is, I wanted to invite Washington's Equality for Asians. And I thought to myself, oh, we can educate them. That'd be awesome. And then I found out more that they are dangerous and they can threaten you and they can harass you. And they have done things with their social media that have painted a picture of Asian Americans. Odin, I don't know what to really do in that type of space.
Let me say one thing real quickly, and there might be other folks who want to chime in also. I think there are sort of three strategies when you're trying to mobilize and organize for change. One is sort of the conversion strategy, where you're trying to take people who are on this particular thing here and get them on your side, right? The second is inoculation. So you're trying to reach people who haven't quite yet been poisoned to go over to that side, and but you're wanting to make sure that they have enough information that they are not vulnerable to that manipulation. And then the third is mobilization. That is to say, mobilizing your own people who are already down for the real struggle, or at least say they are, and can be mobilized with the right narrative and the right strategy. I think sometimes we focus way too much on the conversion piece. That is to say, inviting the adversary in so we can educate them. Look, I mean, I'm not saying it never happens, but the amount of energy that you will have to expend to get that conversion experience is not probably going to be the best use of your time. So instead of trying to flip folks who were already pretty dug in, I would focus more on the inoculation and the mobilization piece, because even if you could get a few people in that group to go, oh, now I see, which is it's not going to happen on a one-shot deal anyway. You'd have to have them back over and over and over again. I'm not sure. By the time you got one of them to flip, you could have mobilized 100 people.
I think that's well said.
Well, then I think with that, I appreciate that question. And thank you for the work you're doing. And thank everybody for coming out.
And that'll do it for another episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise. Please join me again in 2 weeks for the next episode of the show. And in the meantime, you can check out my articles at medium.com, as well as my website, www.timwise.org. And follow the show on Facebook at Speak Out with Tim Wise, on Twitter at Speak Out Tim Wise, as well as on Instagram. Take care and join us again in 2 weeks. Friend.